This is the time set for argument in cases 25-4604 and 25-6300, Federated Indians of Grayton Rancheria versus United States Department of the Interior with Koi Nation as an intervener appellant. So we'll hear first from Mr. Scotton. We'll hear next from Mr. Katyal. We'll then hear from the government, and then we'll hear a rebuttal. Good morning. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please the court. Hagan Scotton for Koi Nation. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes rebuttal, if that's okay with the court. 70 years ago, Koi Nation was wrongly stripped of all its sovereign land. And after decades of struggle and petition and litigation, the DOI decision at issue here righted that wrong and restored Koi Nation to this core attribute of sovereignty, tribal land on which it could govern itself. The complaint here seeks to undo that again. And in the district court, Your Honors, everyone recognized this required a radical change to this court's precedent. That is why the federal government told the district court Koi Nation's motion to dismiss should be granted. It is why the Federated Indians of Grayton Rancheria, which I'm just going to call Grayton, said that it was prepared to challenge this court's precedents en banc or at the Supreme Court. That the district court nonetheless allowed this case to go forward under the public rights exception involved several errors, but I'm going to focus on one. This court and the Supreme Court have been adamant that that exception cannot apply where the case threatens to destroy the legal entitlements of the absent party. And whatever the extent of that phrase, a tribe's sovereignty over land, its only tribal jurisdiction, is a legal entitlement, and there was no dispute that Grayton was trying to destroy that. The district court itself—
When did the legal entitlement come into being? When the trust status was granted?
That's correct, Your Honor. Just as in, for example, Dene or Cascoli, both also agency actions, it comes into effect when the particular agency action that is being challenged took place.
Okay, so here there was a preliminary injunction proceeding. I don't think your client was yet an intervener at that stage, but what would have happened if Judge Lynn had granted the preliminary injunction? There would then be no legal entitlement.
That's correct, Your Honor. In fact, Judge Lynn found that we could not have intervened at that time. We didn't even have a Rule 19A interest.
Okay, but so your view of the law is essentially that up until she could have granted the preliminary injunction without running afoul of some of these tribal sovereign immunity precedents that you reference, but once the trust status was granted by the government, that was sort of the switch that was then flipped?
And that's what this court said in Wilbur v. Locke, a case that I think didn't receive quite enough attention in the papers. So that's another case, like Your Honor alluded to, where there was a preliminary injunction brought before the legal entitlement took place. Right? So that's a case about an agreement over cigarette taxation, and some tribal members who didn't like that prospective agreement that was being negotiated moved to enjoin it. The injunction was pending in the district court, and no one told the district court that the agreement was completed, so the district court there actually went ahead and issued the injunction. On appeal, this court learned that, in fact, the agreement had taken effect, and this court reversed. It didn't say, as Grayton would have it said, well, there was an injunction pending, so there was a lien on the property. It didn't say, well, this is a new legal entitlement, so somehow it doesn't qualify. It said once that agreement came into effect, there was a legal entitlement, Rule 19A was satisfied, the public rights exception doesn't apply, and therefore the case had to be dismissed. This court has said that.
Okay, so what's undisputed here that we are deciding? Are we not to look at any decisions, the decision made by the district court on the summary judgment? Is that totally irrelevant?
That's correct, Your Honor. And this court has said again and again, the Supreme Court said in Pimentel, you don't look at the underlying claims. You don't presume, that was the error committed in Pimentel, you don't presume that the other side is meritorious. Instead, you dismiss before that. In this case, the court has done that. For example, in Cascoli, Your Honor, that case proceeded all the way through trial, and the district court found that the actions taken there, sorry, not Cascoli, American Greyhound, found the actions taken there were, as Grayton alleges here, unauthorized. They were unlawful. And this court, when it got up on appeal, rewound the whole thing and said, no, district court, you erred at the Rule 19 stage. You should have dismissed the case then because the public rights exception didn't apply.
Counsel, is there a procedure by which DOI can strip the COI of their trust status?
There is not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. Only Congress can do that.
So it would take an act of Congress to do that.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's very informative of what you see here. You know,
we're talking about tribal status now?
I thought he was talking about trust status of the land.
Okay.
Both are true, Your Honor. Both status as a federally recognized tribe and trust status of land. And I think that's really indicative, Your Honor. You know, my opponent says the sky will fall if this isn't reviewable. But they have no decision ever, where a court took land out of trust. And I think that tells the court something about this is incredibly rare, but it's also not a power courts have ever enjoyed. Many of this court's cases, Shermoen, Pitt River, Quileute, Hamul Action Committee, which directly says that trust status and land is protected, these are all about the same thing here. The court has always said courts do not look at the legal entitlement to sovereign land, and there's never been a sky is falling problem.
So the big, you know, there's a big looming issue in all of these cases, which is our precedent really good precedent? I know we are stuck with it, but I want to engage with you on that a little bit. I mean, the DNA line about the government never being an adequate representative of an absent tribe, is that really a viable line to have? Because what ends up happening in these cases is that once a decision is made by the government, a tribe can then intervene, and then that's it. And I have a question as to whether our case has maybe gone too far.
So a couple thoughts on that, Your Honor. I want to discuss precedent generally and then why it's really not at issue in this case. So there's two issues here that are raised by anybody. There's a public rights exception. There's no case ever anywhere in any jurisdiction applying that to a tribal sovereign. D.C. Circuit made that point in Kickapoo. So you take that off the table. Your precedent is clearly right and uniform there. Then there's this issue that the government conceded, but I think is here to talk about, which is adequacy. Now, that's where I think Judge Miller, for example, in his concurrence in Maverick said, maybe this court's precedents have gone too far. I don't think this court says the government can never be an adequate representative. In fact, there's several cases, Makah, Southwest Center, Washington v. Daley, where this court found the government to be an adequate representative. The point is, the district court did not abuse its discretion here in finding that the government was not an adequate representative. And I can talk about a lot of things.
Are those for reasons specific to this case or for reasons that are more kind of stylized in the way that DNA suggests that anytime there's a challenge to this kind of thing, the government is never an adequate representative because the government cares about defending its process. It doesn't necessarily care about the ultimate outcome.
I'm not so sure, Your Honor, that the government isn't perhaps sort of making a little bit of a straw man in DNA, because I don't think it says never, ever, ever. Right? It would be impossible for it to, because there's prior precedence to this court. I think there is a high standard for alignment of interests, not just in the specific outcome, but also in the reasoning and general approach, that the district court here found was not satisfied.
Are there specific aspects of this case or the government's relationship with the two tribes that would cause us to conclude that whatever we think about DNA, just on this particular facts, the government is not an adequate representative?
Yes, and there's several in the papers I want to get to, but I want to get to the one that's not in the papers because it occurs post the papers. It makes this an easy, almost why are we here on this issue kind of case. My opponents say, and the cases they cite and the cases Judge Miller relied on, and in Judge Miller and his concurrence, all talk about cases where the government is present tense defending the interest at stake. They all say the government appealed, the government is pressing the tribe's interest. The government has withdrawn its appeal of the summary judgment decision here, and it's on this court's own docket. This court can take notice of it. There is no case anywhere in any jurisdiction that says when the government is only going to be appearing on the other side of the V, the only time a court's ever going to hear from the government again is saying, affirm, let Koi Nation's land go out of trust. No case anywhere says that is still an adequate representative. In fact, the cases such as Alto, Daley, Sack and Fox from the 10th Circuit, Judge Miller's concurrence, all make it a point that the government is defending it right now.
Let me ask you, though, whenever we go back to the determination by the Interior in 2000 of federal recognition of the Koi tribe, and then they sought the restored lands exception so that for the purpose of IGRA. Is that a point where is there any possibility at that time that your client could have opposed that because you knew that in fact they were certainly hoping to get the land or get the reserved interest, the reserved lands for IGRA. Is that just completely separate? There's no way that you could have participated in that. And of course, at that stage, the Department of Interior denied it. And then they appealed it. And then the DC Circuit reversed. So then then COI indeed had the reserved lands for the purpose of IGRA. So I'm just trying to figure out, is your client just a little late in bringing up, let's say, the arguments that you're making here on behalf of your client, that this is completely inappropriate?
So just to be clear, my client is Koi Nation. And so I think that may be a question you're asking.
Okay, I'm sorry.
but to get to Your Honor's point, there are a couple salient points in there. One, the 2019 DDC opinion you refer to saying, wow, Department of Interior is really done wrong by Koi Nation, my client, for decades, is another factor that answers Judge Bress's question.
So let me make it clear then. So that it's your position that the federal tribe should have contested it then?
No, Your Honor. We are not saying that Great or anyone else had to participate in the 2019 decision.
It seems to me that you're saying that the contest could never occur. How could they have contested whether or not COI had the right to the reserved lands for IGRA?
Well, so these are two different...
Any stage where they could do that? Well, of the proceedings? Or otherwise, they're completely out.
So a couple things, Your Honor. 2019 is not what awarded the land to us. That was just recognizing that we were eligible to seek lands because we were, in fact, a restored tribe, because the Department of Interior couldn't keep pretending we weren't a restored tribe. Their position was, well, you were always a tribe. We failed to treat you as one for decades, but you were always a tribe, so you
right.
can't be restored.
Right, and so I get that. But then there's the stage after that where COI makes approaches the Department of Interior and asks, after they've been recognized for the restored lands for IGRA, is that a point where you think Federate should have come in there and raised the issue that they're raising now, that this is totally inappropriate? And then the Department of Interior denied it.
Well, they did do that, Your Honor. There were years of process, about 3 years of process, where Grayton and Koi Nation are both making submissions and lobbying about whether or not this parcel, the Shiloh site, should be taken to trust.
Okay. So those were never resolved? Those were litigation? No. They were never appealed? And are those separate cases other than this one now that it suddenly raised its head? It's never been decided whether or not the reserved lands exception was appropriate, except in the Court of Appeals much later. So I'm asking, of course, Federate is claiming that this was inappropriate, that this should not have happened. So is it your position they can't ever raise that, or they couldn't have raised it long ago?
I'm not sure exactly what it is in Your Honor's question.
Do you? Let me make sure I understand. You're way ahead of me.
Sure.
So I understand what Federate's position is with respect to why your client shouldn't have this land. And they have historical background and that it shouldn't have been a reserved land for the purpose of IGRA. When should they have raised that? Or is it your position they never could raise it at any time?
It is our position that they could raise it in the agency determination, as they did for years. It is our position that they were free to seek a preliminary injunction, which they did. They lost. They did not appeal. They chose not to appeal the loss of the PI. And it is not my position. It is the consistent holding of this
court. Was it the same issues here, so that it's a matter of res judicata, that the issue has already been resolved on the facts that the Federated is raising as to why your client isn't entitled?
Sorry, so the issues obviously in this appeal are really just the Rule 19 issues. The issues in the summary judgment case the one the government has abandoned.
Right, that's different.
That's
so
different.
What I'm saying, though, is when should they have raised their equitable defense?
I don't know that they have an equitable defense.
I'm saying they filed a lawsuit. Your position is that your client could intervene and then move to dismiss, and that's what the court did. I'm just curious if another tribe contests the restored lands exception, when do they do that?
Sure. Let me give Your Honor some examples. I think that's probably helpful because our position essentially at the point at which it as Judge Brest started with, the point at which it becomes legal entitlement, that is the point at which we can intervene and move to dismiss, and it should have been granted. And that's what this court always says. So look at Quileute. Two tribes contesting before the agency who's going to get inherited property.
Okay, so this wasn't a contest. Your client was granted federal recognition in the year 2000, and then they requested...
Sorry, Your Honor, no. Point Nation has been recognized...
It was recognized.
Decades
recognized.
Past. They realized they made the mistake in not treating them as recognized around the year 2000.
Okay.
Go ahead.
In the year 2000, about that time, right? And so then, much later, 2006, they sought the reserved lands exception. Is it then... Were the issues, did the Department of Interior make a mistake? They should have considered every tribe's right then. And they actually ruled against your client. And then it was appealed and it was changed. So I'm just trying to understand every time one of the Native American tribes requests, they've been recognized, a reserved lands exception, is the Department of Interior to consider everything like the other tribes and whether or not in the equitable arguments that are being made by Federated?
So no, Your Honor, no one is taking that position. My friends can correct me, but no one thinks that other tribes participate at the stage where you're just asking.
Could they have?
I don't think so. Nobody thinks they could have. Nobody thinks you can participate where
it is. So then they could never raise the issue.
No, these are totally different issues, Your Honor. Totally different issues. Whether Khoi Nation qualifies as a restored tribe, which is this incredibly idiosyncratic thing, there's only three pending cases about the restored lands exception. Nobody thinks another tribe could say, and you're not even that kind of a tribe. The arguments here are not about that at all, anywhere. The arguments here, and my friends can correct me, are about the specific parcel at issue. Their claim... Grayton's claim was that this particular site, the Shiloh site, could not be taken.
So what you're saying then is that when the Department of Interior, in fact, gave them the restored lands for the purpose of IGRA, these issues couldn't be raised whatsoever. In other words, the particular area that was chosen, that was what came up much later, that was the only thing litigated?
Right, so the issue of the particular area chosen is litigated, as well, it's subject to agency process for about 3 years.
So that has to be a decision by the Department of Interior.
And it was. There's no one disputing here that the Department of Interior, after extended process, which Grayton says was inadequate. That was sort of their underlying claims. After extended process in January of 2025, several months into this case, Department of Interior takes the land into trust. And in every decision of this court, and I'm naming a bunch of recent ones because I take that really to be the gravamen of Grayton's objection, is that no one's defending the district court's reasoning, which was that it...
So what I'm asking is, before the lawsuit was filed,
yes.
Did they have a right to participate? Did they participate with the Department of Interior?
Yes. There was extensive consultation.
And so that was Administrative Procedures Act that applied?
Correct.
Okay. So they had, is it your position, they had the right then that to raise the issues that they're raising now about this particular piece of land? And
yes.
They lost?
That is exactly right. Now, I want to be clear. The district court thought they should have been given more process than they got. The record of process is extensive. It's undisputed. There were multiple surveys. There were dog surveys. There were letters. There was letter writing. There are archaeologists on site, and he told them to stop digging because there were no cultural remains. So I don't think it is a valid claim, but that is their claim, that they got a bunch of process, they should have gotten yet more process. And they got
Did they participate?
Yes. And again, they would say they
adequately, to have a right to adequately participate in that decision.
So that is I think what was issue in the NHPA claim. And I think the district court's summary judgment decision, which is not at issue and under cases such as Cascoli, never should have been reached. But in that case, the district court said there was enough consultation on NEPA, but not enough under NHPA. And that's really the merits of the case that the government is no longer willing to defend.
So, can I ask you,
after the decision was made,
Your Honor,
by the Department of Interior, it was over until they filed a lawsuit?
Well, they filed the lawsuit before the decision, much as in Wilbur. And then that's where they lost.
Okay.
They had the PI and they lost. And then, yes, once the legal entitlement comes in, I do see them over time, but if you have another question.
Yep.
Once the legal entitlement takes effect, then it can't be challenged. And that's all these cases, right? So in Cascoli, there's a change to mining permitting that increases the lessor's ability to, mine within 100 yards of a burial site. It's an administrative agency decision. It's challenged the seconds it made. This court says it should have been dismissed, even though it was new, as Grayton would put it. You see the same thing in Clinton. Clinton is a case where the intervening tribe had no prior right, but a federal statute implemented by Department of the Interior gave the tribe the ability to offer leases. Hadn't offered them yet, but would get income from them. They intervene, they move to dismiss, and this court says, that's right, you have a legal entitlement, not some reliance interest, a legal entitlement, and therefore, public rights exception is
applied. This is what I was wanting to get at and ask your views on, which relates to, I think, part of the district court's reasoning to say there was no gaming already underway, and there's some language in DNA Citizens to the effect that, here the mining had already started. I know you resist that line, and why?
Sure. I think I resist that line for a couple reasons, Your Honor. One, it's one sentence in several paragraphs from 858 to 860. The gravamen of which is, here is why this case, that is to say Dene, is more like Cascoli than Connor. And it is not actually imposing a reliance interest, which would have been totally inconsistent with all this court's prior precedents, the ones I've just been talking about. And in fact, if you look at the facts of Dene, and I'd point the court particularly to the facts section, but also to note 3, it's clear that actually all the activity at issue that's being challenged, all the activity the court is referring to in that sentence, is activity that took place after the challenge decision. These are all things, as here, that the tribe did once it got this new decision that expanded chronologically and geographically mining. And you have that here, Your Honor. I understand why Grayton, for sort of competitive reasons, is focused on casino rights, but Koi Nation had immediate reliance, has $147,000 in tax savings that it got from Sonoma County by virtue of the land having been taken into trust. That's something that has already happened based on the record of decision. It was negotiating with local governments for things like fire and health services, all the things you do as a government. It was governing itself. It had the right then and there to negotiate gaming pacts when it was doing. So it is, in fact, leaving aside that I think I'm right on reliance, there is no reliance inquiry. My opponent has never quoted a single sentence saying there's a reliance inquiry. If you did need it, you would have it here, Your Honor, in spades. It's really hard.
Okay. I think unless there's further questions for you, we'll have you take a seat. We'll put five minutes on the clock for rebuttal, and we'll hear from Grayton Rancheria.
Thank you, Judge Bress. May it please the court. This lawsuit was filed before the Interior Department even took the land into trust, and it challenges major new agency action. There are 3 arguments for why we win: the public rights exception, inadequate representation under Rules 19 and 24, and equity. And not only does my friend have to run the table on all 3, I think he has to convince you that there's no wiggle room in the cases, that precedent compels you to rule for them. That's because, as the Supreme Court put it in Bowen, there's there's a strong presumption of judicial review over agency action. Loper Bright says something similar. And as the Alaska brief, joined by 9 other states, points out, COI's view would mean a federal agency can make the most massive decisions affecting tribes, including stripping other tribes of their rights, and there's no judicial review whatsoever. This case is a perfect example. The district court found the Interior Department committed 3 errors, likely destroying our tribe's ancestral remains. All 3 are unreviewable, according to COI. Heck, an intern could, I don't know, sign off on 1 million acres of land and put that into trust, and there would be no judicial review whatsoever.
Right, but I mean, an intern could have approved the mining permits in Diné, too, right? And there would be no judicial review either. So I guess the big question, you know, I have for you is how can we do what you're asking given the case law?
Yeah, so I think, first of all, there's a very simple, easy way to do so here, Judge Bress, and it goes to your very first question that you asked my friend. You asked him, when does the legal entitlement arrive? Answer, quote, when the trust status is granted. The most important point I'll leave you with today, and it's at the district court, page 3 of its opinion. This lawsuit was filed on November 25th, 2024. The land was taken into trust afterwards, 2 months later, in January.
Right, so, but I mean, there was a PI proceedings, right? And your client could have appealed the denial of the preliminary injunction, but for whatever reason didn't.
Well, here's why. Here's what the district court said, also at page 3. Quote, on January 10th, 2025, the court denied Grayton's motion for preliminary injunction on the basis no irreparable harm would result. The court reached that conclusion in part because the federal defendants represented the land into trust transaction could be reversed. It's now come to light that prior to the PI hearing, the federal defendants and COI had communicated about the possibility.
I know, I saw that. I mean, I guess the question is, what do we... How much work does that do? The district court didn't think it did enough work.
I think it does 2 types of work here. One is just as a matter of equity, and of course, Rules 19 and 24 are all about equity. These folks sat on their hands when they were having discussions with the government, and when the government went to the court and said, no need for a preliminary injunction here, no irreparable harm, because the Supreme Court decision in Matchabewish says you can reverse a land in a trust decision.
Right, but it's not about, you know, private communications, it's about the nature of our law, and everyone knows what the law is or can be expected to know.
Yeah, and if as long as there is a way to repair that and to have it's not irreparable, and that's of course what
do you have a claim? Was this a representation by government counsel?
I think there were questions about this at the hearing and by government counsel.
Do you have a claim for fraud upon the court?
No, not at all. We're just saying as a matter of equity, when you're talking about stripping judicial review entirely, this case looks different. And this brings me to my second point, Judge Bress, and it's another question you asked my friend. You said, what about that language in Diné? He said, well, it's only one sentence. Well, it's a pretty important sentence, and it's a heck of a lot more important than anything, a heck of a lot better precedent than anything they've cited. What does Diné says? It says that the agency issued the ROD in 2015, quote, since obtaining those permits and approvals, the tribe made significant financial investments in power plants and mines and secured a $115 million line of credit. The lawsuit in Diné was filed the next year after all of those investments took place in reliance on the agency decision. That's entirely different than this case, and that's why Diné goes on to say at page 860, unlike in Connor, where surface disturbing activity had not even been authorized or begun, the activities by the ROD here are taking place already. This litigation threatens to destroy the non-party's
somewhat uncomfortable way, though, to start dividing the cases because, you know, a legal entitlement, we know when it begins. Reliance interest is a little bit harder to know.
So I think that the idea that the legal entitlement begins with the agency action, we just think is absolutely wrong. There's no case.
Okay, so you had filed a suit, but let's suppose that you hadn't filed a suit before that was done. The DOI announced its decision, and then you took your rights under the APA.
Yeah.
And filed a timely APA appeal. Does that mean that the rights were not vested until the APA proceedings?
No, we would still win for reasons the district court said. They gave 3 reasons, and I'll go through them. But we think this case is easy because, of course, we did file the lawsuit before, so you don't need to think about en banc or anything like that. Here are the 3 reasons. This is also at ER page 3. The rights are not destroyed because COI has not begun construction on the casino, starting gaming operations. Second, and the event the land taken to transact land in a trust is reversed, COI would retain the rights of ownership in fee simple. And third, COI would also remain free to have the transaction reinstated after the required consultations were completed.
Yeah, it still doesn't quite answer the question as to when the rights vest. So my question, which I don't think it got addressed, was do the rights not vest until the time for an APA challenge for judicial review expires?
So I think the rights vest when an agency decision has taken place and people have acted in some sort of reliance on that, whether it's mining, whether it's construction activities, something that shows that the underlying action is different. And Judge Bybee, here's a good example. In Hamul Action, the lawsuit did the same thing as this lawsuit does in one sense. It challenged the land in a trust transaction and tried to get it reversed. But there, what the theory was that the tribe wasn't a properly recognized tribe. A lawsuit that does that imposes collateral attack not just on the agency action, but on something that pre-existed the agency action there, whether they have sovereignty at all, whether they're a tribe. And that's why Hamul Action says what it says. If we did the same thing here, if we filed a lawsuit saying, hey, Interior, you misbehave, you got this wrong because COI is not a recognized tribe, that is a lawsuit whose relief radiates beyond the agency action itself. So when you ask when does the legal entitlement arise, I think they have to point to a distinct legal right that exists above and beyond what the agency action that's being challenged in the underlying lawsuit
is. Is that really consistent with the case law, right?
I think it's consistent with every case. I think there's no case that says to the contrary. And indeed, if you went down that road, there would be no public rights exception at all.
Hey, I think some of the arguments you're making are tempting as an original matter. The difficulty I have is that we have all these cases. No tribe is winning on the public rights. No intervening no party like your client is winning on public rights. And they're not winning on 19B. We hear circuit precedent. We have a wall of circuit precedent, right? So I look at these things and say, okay, well, you're asking us to do something that really has not been done before.
So I disagree with that in part. So we certainly don't disagree with the wall. We think it exists for Rule 19 and 24. It's not about the public rights exception at all. With respect to the public rights exception, McCaw in footnote 6 does say in exactly a circumstance like this, in which you have NEPA claims, in which all that you're seeking to do is not destroy an underlying entitlement, but remand to the agency, just like Connor, and then you can have the agency, in fact, do the very same thing. My friend can win his land and trust transaction. He's just got to go to Interior and do the procedures in the right way.
Although it's not, at least according to Judge Lynn, it's not just a matter of the procedures, right? There was some more substantive problem with just treating this as their property, their tribal property, it seems.
Well, I think the reason, you know, the gravamen of the complaint here is these administrative procedures claims, and the Macaw says, as well as other decisions of this court, that those are things in which you do transcend the private rights that were at issue. Now, the reason why I think you don't have many public rights cases, Your Honor, is because, as Judge Silver was getting at before, the government is often held to be an adequate representative in these cases, and so in Sack and Fox and Barnett and Ramah, in all of these cases, you don't get to the public rights exception. The times in which this court has denied the public rights exception are all circumstances in which there is some pre-existing right in reliance on it. Here, you've got none of that, both because, of course, the lawsuit was filed before there any kind of reliance could occur because of before the land and trust transaction, but also because the lawsuit here seeks relief that is far more modest than was at issue in Maverick and DNA and all of those cases. And all those
cases, I guess it depends on your perspective on that, right? Because, you know, if you're talking about a tribe that doesn't have anything else, and you're saying this one tribal, this is the one thing, the one land they have, that seems like a big deal.
So I'm glad you asked about that, because there's no case that says all land is different than some land. They can't cite to anything. But more importantly, here we meet that test anyway, because we're not destroying all their land. It's exactly like Connor and the language at page 1461, in which the court says, look, at the end of the day, all the relief that's being sought here is to send this back to the agency. And you might get the oil and gas leases at the end of the day as long as you follow the same procedures. And that's why this case is so different from normal tribal immunity cases, because tribal immunity exists to be a shield to protect something a tribe already has and to avoid being hailed into court. But here is Khoi is using it as a sword to end it. And Khoi knew when they got their land and trust transaction, when they pushed for it, they'd get for the land subject to normal rules, including all the procedural rules of the APA, three separate statutes, all are nullified under their reading because they say, you know, that because they say that they are necessary parties. That is, there's no case that justifies that result.
I ask you, what is your response to the government dismissing the appeal of the summary judgment ruling?
Yeah, so I'm glad you asked.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that's on inadequate representation. Sorry, please.
Oh, that's exactly what I would have said.
So we think we'd win on public rights, but as we get to the second argument about Rules 19 and 24, inadequate representative, and the government abandoning the appeal, I think there's a few problems with that. One is the question on appeal here is whether the district court erred and abused its discretion in granting, you know, in reaching the decision it did. And so the question is,
What did the district court do?
Yeah, so the district court here, I think, you know, did something in a way that I think is right, which is it balanced everything and said, look, Khoi should have its day in court. We want them to have a voice. We thought they could do it with amicus plus status. We didn't think they needed to be interveners, but they could be permissive interveners. The district court did something more here. We don't think that was totally right, but you know, we can see the logic behind that. We think that if you got into the question about Rules 19 and 24, it's totally wrong to think that the government not appealing makes them an inadequate representative. After all, that's often proper representation when you're a government attorney. It's something, of course, I did in the Solicitor General's office all the time. There are several cases that say this. My friend said there are no cases. I'll give you Shiglow versus City of Preston in the Eighth Circuit in 1997, Little Rock versus North Little Rock in the Eighth Circuit in 2004, the Fifth Circuit in Saldano versus Roach in 2004. All of these are cases that say dropping an appeal doesn't make someone an inadequate representative. And so, here there's...
So for your client, if we remanded to the Department of Interior, what happens?
Yeah, so then so you what, go through...
So because the Department of Interior so far has an appeal, they've been very inconsistent about whether or not they're going to be fair. Of course, it's a government agency. We always assume that. So why is that, first of all, procedurally appropriate? And then what do you expect to get from it?
Yeah, so that's part of our point, which is, you know, this should go back to the Interior Department. They should have the right official sign, not some low-level official. And by the way, that's why this whole government dropped appeal, inadequate representative thing makes no sense. They had a chance in the district court to make whatever defense they wanted to on the merits. They had party status, as you were saying. They filed a whopping zero because it's impossible to defend the idea that a low-level person can sign off on a major decision like this. So what would happen,
Judge
Silver?
Would we be deciding then that the Department of Interior really was wrong, made a mistake? They should have gone forward, just like you're saying, and make the decision and resolve it.
Exactly.
So in other words, remand it back to the Administrative Procedure Act proceedings and let everybody...
Exactly, and Khoi might get, just like in Connor, exactly what they want at the end of the day, which is land and trust, but done under the right procedures, the same procedures, by the way, we had to follow when we got our land taken into the trust, the same procedures everyone has to follow.
So what would the order... We're ordering, essentially, that you go back to the Department of Interior. What would we be telling the Department of Interior?
You would
follow the law, but what would that be?
You'd affirm the district court judgment, which said that they vacated the decisions in this case by the Interior. They would then have the ability to go back. And if Interior, and the most important point, if Interior made a mistake and didn't do something that was fair to Khoi, Khoi could go in and seek judicial review in an Article 3 court of that. That's a vital, precious right that Loper Bright says.
Okay, so
they're taking that away from us.
When you say that we would affirm the decision of the district court. That's the decision on the summary judgment or the decision, what decision?
Yeah, we think both the decision on summary judgment.
So you believe summary judgment is, so you're saying that although it really hasn't been briefed, that this decision was correct, there are no genuine issues of material fact that need to be resolved, And that hasn't been litigated. We decide that the district court was correct on the facts, and then we send it back to the Department of Interior. Is that it?
That's exactly right. And my friend on the other side, when you asked him that question, cited the Pimentel case. But Pimentel says exactly that. Pimentel says you can, as a court, look to see and is deciding adequate representation, the strength of the arguments. Here, the government threw in the towel on the impossibility of defending the idea that this low-level person could do this. And boy,
so,
the precedent—
as a matter of law, you're asking us to say the facts found by the district court. You're not asking us to remove. I mean, certainly don't want us to make the finding the district court made a mistake, that the facts are undisputed and the district court made the right decision.
Yeah, the government tried for 70 pages, which is why we think they are inadequate represented, to defend what it did. But at the end of the day, it was indefensible. And I suspect that's why COI, when the district court gave them party status and gave an opportunity to defend what Interior did, said a precious whopping zero. And now they come in and say, oh, the government's an inadequate representative? I mean, you know, like, what special argument do they want to make to defend the idea that an intern or a Dearman could sign off on something
I'm sorry to ask you this question because I should know, I guess, but on the motion for summary judgment, did the Department of Interior participate on the motion, or was it just between the two tribes?
Yeah, no. They filed a 70-page brief, Your Honor, defending all this. And that's why we think the idea that they're inadequate representatives, sometimes they are, particularly when there's a divergence, when there's existing entitlements, those kinds of things. That's what DNA at pages 852 and 53 go through all the cases. But here, you've got the opposite record. And the district court made finding after finding, both about that and about the fact that the public right here, that this is about public rights. The district court here, unlike the other cases like Cascoli and the like, went through the counts of this complaint and pointed out in painstaking detail these statutes are all about public interest, environmental protection.
What if the government had not defended the challenge below? Would you say that they were an adequate representative then?
Well, it depends on the reasons why. I mean, they do have a trust relationship. So in general, we presume, and I think this court's case laws say, you presume a bit of adequacy, but of course it's rebuttable. And if there were good arguments to be made, here we just don't think ultimately there are, which is why the government threw in the towel. But if there are good arguments to be made and they're not making them, yes, I think that's a different case. Public rights exception might still apply in those cases. You know, there may be other ways of dealing with it, but sure.
So let me ask, we're now talking about sort of record-specific reasons as to why the government may or may not be an adequate representative. And so here, they litigated the case in the district court, then they are not pursuing the appeal. To evaluate whether their representation is adequate, do I need to do some kind of diagnostic on how good were the arguments that they made below, and really should they have been pressing them on appeal? Or how am I to make that assessment?
I think here it's very easy because COI had the chance to make all the arguments, whatever arguments that, you know, they could have identified. I mean,
they've appealed, right? They've appealed that, and right, that has stayed. But so we'll hear whatever arguments those will be. But on the adequacy of representation, again, putting DNA to the side a second, I just want to know from your perspective how we should do the analysis.
Yeah, so I think here's how you do it. This court's cases give you two things you have to do. First, in Northwest Forest versus Glickman, you said it's their burden to identify some of those arguments. And then in the Iraqi case, you said they've got to identify specific arguments that they would make that the government is not making. And I think you don't then have to get into what you're saying, which is the kind of more difficult question of really getting into the meat of the arguments. They've got to identify them. You know, in the district court, they identified zero. Before this court, they identify some sort of vague thing about how they might challenge government regulations, which they didn't even say in the district court, and which wouldn't, of course, work. If they challenged those restored lands regulations, it would just mean, and I think this was Judge Silver's point earlier, they would get a remand to the Interior Department to restart the process again, which is, of course, what we want, which is why they don't identify it.
Going to our circuit precedent, what do you believe is the right way that these kinds of cases should be evaluated with intervening tribes? So just put aside, you know, where do you think, 'cause I understand your position that you're going to continue to litigate this, which is your full right, but I want to know from you now, kind of what's the preview on that? What should the law be for how these things should work?
We think there's a, as I said at the outset, there's a strong presumption of judicial review in the law. And yes, there are cases, the so-called wall of cases for Rules 19 and 24, but they don't govern the public rights exception, and in particular circumstances in which there isn't any sort of reliance or existing interest.
Well, so do you think there should be a reinvigorated public rights exception, or do you think that DNA is really the source of the issue?
I think all you got to do is apply Connor and DNA, and you get to exactly where we're saying. And so could I imagine a hypothetical en banc argument that follows more like what Judge Miller said? 100%. I mean, I don't think you need to go there in this case. Obviously, we will if you say that's what the cases compel. But we think when you read those cases, for all my friend can mine them for, no pun intended, they don't get them where they want to go, because in this case, there was no existing entitlement, no collateral attack beyond the agency action itself.
That's what the Department of Interior held or argued in their motion for response to the motion for summary judgment or the cross motions?
Yes.
That's exactly what they argued?
Yes, and if you go down their road, my friends wrote on the other side, like just on land and trusts, there are 56 million acres of land and trust right now. That's more than the entire state of New York. Of that becomes a law-free zone under their interpretation, no judicial review at all. That's why the Alaska brief is warning you, whether you get there through the en banc mechanism, that's obviously one way to do it. But in this case, it's much simpler because you have not a reinvigorated public rights exception. We're asking you to just apply McCaw.
But if we were starting this all from the beginning and we were asking, all right, how should this really work when we've got a tribe coming in and saying, that's my legal entitlement, and the government saying, well, yeah, but this is a lawsuit against us and we can defend it. Is the answer that most of the time the government's going to be fine except for certain circumstances where maybe they're not? I want to kind of hear from you what you think that the area should look like.
Yeah, no, I do think that would be, I think where a way to write the law that I think balances the right of judicial review over agency action. We definitely think that people like Khoi tribes like Khoi should be able to participate in court proceedings and have a voice, whether as amicus plus or as permissive intervener. But the idea that you can come in and terminate litigation on the basis of tribal immunity, I mean, tribal immunity is done to protect tribes. This case illustrates, and again, it's unlike other cases because the tribe is the plaintiff, it illustrates exactly the problem, what calling this tribal immunity, because Khoi knew when they got the land in a trust transaction, they, like every other tribe, take that land subject to the laws of the United States. And what they're trying to do is say, we're special and different, and we get to have this land transaction with no law whatsoever, no judicial review whatsoever. There's zero cases that support that astounding proposition.
If the Department of Interior had taken the position in favor of Khoi, would it be over? I mean, you wouldn't be appealing it because it's your position. The department did represent your client, and now their claim that, well, they're not really capable of representing you. So if they had taken the position that summary judgment on the most important issue, the public exception issue, would you have a claim, or would you just appeal it, or what
here,
would you do?
So here, that is what happened. The Interior Department took a position against us and said that everything that was done was lawful. They tried mightily in 70 pages to do that, Your Honor. And at the end of the day, they lost on the merits in a detailed opinion. And now the government is saying we're not going to appeal that. That isn't an adequate representation. That is the essence of adequate representation.
So you already know what the department is going to say. Mm-hmm. But you're asking to send it back to the department. So why is that a new issue? Is it just going to be relitigated on the question of whether
Go back to Interior, signed by an appropriate official, if they can get an appropriate official to sign, going through the processes, the NEPA process,
What are you going to argue to the Department of Interior that their position was wrong?
Yeah, that they have to follow all the...
What did they do that was wrong? Because they basically decided that there was no public exception, am I right? That was what their position was, and they did the right thing.
So what we would say to the Interior Department on remand is you've got to follow the proper consultation rules, environmental, historical, and the like. My friend says, and he's right, we had some chance to do that with Interior before, but our whole lawsuit, and the reason we won, is that wasn't enough. And Loper Bright gives us a right to Article 3 judicial review in 702 and 706 of the APA over a claim like that. And so all we're seeking for, we want to go back to the agency, go through the same processes that every other tribe goes through when they get land.
So why do you think your position will be meritorious before the Department of Interior going back? Because there's no, let's say, essentially harmless error. The Department of Interior is going to make the same decision.
Yeah, so it goes back just like in Connor. We don't know what's going to happen on remand. We have views that this land is our land. I mean, after all, you know, this land was where a bunch of ancestral remains and other things were found. They have very little connection to this land. You know, they have other land, like in Clear Lake, and I should have pointed that out earlier when you said they taking all the land. This is about taking all the land from them. That's absolutely not true. They have their ancestral lands are in Clear Lake, and they've been filing lawsuits about that particular area of land and blocking other development. It's not our fault that they decided to build it here.
So let's suppose that at the end of the DOI proceedings that DOI had agreed with your client and denied the COI's request to place the land in trust. If the COI had then taken an APA at a 706 under the APA review, would you be a necessary party and would you have the right to assert sovereign immunity and block their appeal?
I don't think so. Again, for the same reason, that feels like gamesmanship, Your Honor. It feels
it's gamesmanship. Yeah. I'm trying to figure out whether it's going to be played by both sides.
Yeah, I don't think that there's any precedent for the idea that when you're talking about brand new agency action, that you can use tribal immunity to defend.
And the Groton would be okay with that. They would not assert sovereign immunity.
Yeah, I think that's a terrible way of viewing the law. I mean, it's so inconsistent with all of our nation's traditions from Marbury to the APA and the like. And certainly immunity is part of our tradition.
Really, though, I mean, if the agency had said, no, we're making a finding that this is actually the ancestral home of your clients and they have the rights that go with that, you really wouldn't say that that's a legal entitlement that clicks in?
No, I mean, we believe very much in the principle of judicial review. I mean, we think that's how I started the argument. That's what the Supreme Court says in Bowen and Loper Bright. And so sometimes you can have limited exceptions, like DNA and Maverick, the Wall cases in which you have pre-existing entitlements that are collaterally attacked by the lawsuit. The hypothetical that Judge Bybee has given me is nothing like that. And in that circumstance, I think it would be a very dangerous thing to say, to terminate judicial review on that basis.
I think
there's an exception here. You recognize the sovereign immunity that's been around since Dene. So, but what you're saying is that the sovereign immunity doesn't apply because your client hasn't had judicial review. Is that it? A judicial review and also administrative review. Is that you can't do that unless there's been fairness?
So that a little bit. What we're saying is that tribal immunity exists. We're not disagreeing with that notion, but we are disagreeing with the idea that a tribe could affirmatively come into a case in which they haven't been hailed into court and plead tribal immunity to terminate all judicial review whatsoever.
In other words, your client has been denied due process.
Of that sort.
So we call
it due process in our brief. We also call it 702 and 706, and we call it Marbury, you know, in principles of, you know, first principles. But again, the ultimate fundamental point is if you buy what he's selling, you're creating a law-free zone for the Interior Department to do whatever it wants, and there isn't a precedent that goes that far. Could you squint at the cases and possibly get where he wants to get? I don't disagree you possibly could, but that is a horrible way to read the precedent.
What's the best case that establishes for you,
Connor,
that immunity doesn't apply in this situation?
Well, Connor and DNA say that in this situation you do not dismiss, you apply the public rights exception.
Okay. I think we have your argument.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Katyal. We'll hear from the government.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, Daniel Halinen for the United States. Thank you for granting our motion for divided time. I'll endeavor to be brief. We're here today for the
limited... Nobody's been too successful at that.
I'll try. We're here for the limited purpose today of explaining why we think the district court's disposition aligns with the government's overall view of the proper application of Rule 19 in APA cases. Although the court has issued a number of decisions that foreclose review in these cases, we think it would be appropriate for the court to take this opportunity to identify ways to limit the scope of Diné citizens and find a way to avoid deepening any divisions between
the court. So this is a change, obviously, from what you seem to argue in the district court. It seemed to acknowledge this case needed to be dismissed.
Correct. You know, we said in district court that we acknowledge that the court's precedents apply, and we haven't contested on appeal.
Right, but those precedents apply to us, too.
Right. Yes.
So I guess the question is, how can we do what you want to do if you said to the district court, these precedents require this, they require that of me, too?
Sure. We think the district court found a way to avoid dismissing the case, and because that aligns with our overall view of how Rule 19 should apply in these cases, we would urge the court to find a way to affirm. I recognize, as Your Honor was discussing earlier, that that can be difficult of a task. And so if the court were inclined to conclude that this was, you know, something that was totally controlled by the existing precedent, we would just urge the court to consider in crafting its opinion that it's important to find ways to not expand in a citizens beyond the scope of where it is already to avoid a sort of broad world where every one of these cases, every trust acquisition decision is subject to a unilateral veto by an absent tribe or tribal entity that has...
Yeah, no, this has been the government's consistent position on this, I know, because I was on the Klamath case and the same point was made there. But on the adequacy of the government's representation, it's pointed out that the government dismissed the appeal of Judge Lynn's summary judgment ruling. So how do you reconcile these points, that you're an adequate representative, but at the same time, you're apparently submitting to her ruling?
So 2 points. On appeal, we haven't contested adequate representation. We are just sort of urging the court to affirm on the public rights ground. But I do think a decision not to appeal can't render the government an inadequate representative of a third party, because the decision has to necessarily be made at the time of the Rule 12b-7 motion before there's a final judgment, before the government determines whether to proceed. So if the test is there's a possibility the government won't appeal, then every case would have that possibility baked
in. But here there's a knowledge that they dismissed the appeal, so we know.
Well, I agree with Mr. Katyal that the proper focus of the court's analysis is whether the district court, in denying the motion to dismiss, acted, you know, abused her discretion. And so at that stage of the litigation, it's simply impossible for the district court to have known that we were going to decide against appeal. And so it can't be the case that after the fact, only after a final judgment on appeal, suddenly there's a Rule 19 issue where there wasn't one.
Well, it seems a little weird to blind ourselves to that. I mean, it seems we have to make heads or tails of it one way or the other in terms of whether it's relevant and whether it matters.
I would say that fundamentally the decision whether to appeal doesn't affect whether we're an adequate representative. We vigorously defended this decision in district court. We took this decision for the benefit of the tribe. And so we are an adequate representative because we are defending our own decision on the grounds that we established in the record, which is what APA review requires.
I mean, but Dina kind of talks about this. He says, it might be the case that actually the interests diverge. And it seems that here the interests actually did diverge.
I think... the ultimate decision whether to appeal, I think, you know, you could fit that within the language from Diné citizen. But again, we obviously disagree with Diné citizen. So we just think it's appropriate to find ways to limit that. And if that can be accomplished by concluding that, you know, the ultimate appeal decision isn't sort of the type of thing that Diné citizens was talking about, and that's not explicit in the case at all, we think that would be the better resolution of the case rather than sort of...
Counsel, does the government agree that the vesting took place once DOI issued its decision?
I think the best way to understand when there was... rights that would be, excuse me, I think the best way to understand that part of the public rights analysis is that the rights that we're talking about are rights that pre-exist the government decision to take land into trust. So I think you can see that, although it's not explicit, in cases like Diné citizens and Cascoli, where the court is talking about long-standing mining operations, things that predated...
Yeah, but here, you're taking land into trust. That decision was made as of a particular day by DOI. Is that when the trust decision vested, gave them the vested rights in the trust lands?
Yes, it created a legal interest in the tribe at that time.
But- And can that, and do you agree that that can only be reversed by Congress at this point? That it would take an act of Congress in order to allow DOI to strip them of that trust status?
When land is taken into trust, if the court concludes that that was improper, we can file a quitclaim deed, which is what we did here, and took the land out of trust.
Under what circumstances can you take the land out of trust?
If the court determines that a land into trust.
Yeah, but it looks like we don't have any avenue for getting there. But if there's no way for DOI, DOI has decided not to appeal this, evidently thinks that it made some mistakes. Can DOI reverse its own decision putting this land in trust without the intervention of the court?
After it's already been taken out of trust?
It's already in trust.
It's been taken out of trust.
I'm sorry, the land is...
out of trust, pursuant to the district court's decision.
Oh,
Assume that we reverse the district court in this case.
And
DOI has effectively admitted by dismissing its appeal that it thinks that it made some mistakes, so procedural mistakes, substantive mistakes, whatever, in the proceedings. Does DOI have any way to take this land back out of trust?
Back from the into coy? Trust?
Well, to take it to deprive the coy of their trust status with respect to this parcel.
Oh, I see.
They'll still be the owner in fee simple.
I understand.
But the question is can you reverse the trust, the decision to place that piece of property into trust?
So I think if the court reversed the denial of dismissal and required the district court to dismiss the action, I think it would depend a little bit.
Okay, and if we didn't do that, does DOI have any, I'm just asking for, in not only in this case, but in any case, can DOI come back and say a mistake was made and we think that that this land ought to be taken out of trust?
So I think we wouldn't unilaterally take the land out of trust without an order from the court. I apologize if I'm not answering.
Is that a matter of policy or is that a matter of law?
I confess I don't know exactly what the legal...
The COI have said that we would take an act of Congress.
Yeah, I apologize. I just don't know the answer to the question.
It's now vested. They now have sovereign immunity, and therefore DOI can't do anything with respect to that.
Absent. So our view is that pursuant to a court order, we could, but, you know, I don't have an answer to the court.
So it's your position that what the district court did is that you had no choice but to taking it out of trust.
Yes.
And that, so what did you do to do that? What did the Department of Interior do? It just said, we're going to follow the order or final decision? What is that?
Yes, the district court directed us to take the land out of trust, and we filed a quit claim deed.
Okay.
So it's now
you actually administratively, right. It's out of trust.
Yes.
Okay. Counsel, can you offer any explanation for why the government gave misleading information to the district court?
I don't think we misled the district court, Your Honor. There was a sort of quick series of events around a holiday with a PI motion. So, you know, I think the district court has addressed that, and I think, you know, government counsel acted appropriately.
Did the government tell the district court that this decision could be reversed without the PI?
Yes, we did, Your Honor.
Okay, and that's not true. It doesn't appear to be true. I assume that the government wasn't thinking, well, you could just cite the public lands exception, the public interest exception.
Subject to a subsequent Rule 19 motion, we weren't able to do that if the district court agreed with them. Yes. I believe my time has expired. I'm happy to answer any other questions, but otherwise we would urge the court to affirm the district court, or if not, you know, take into consideration the government's concerns about the continued expansion of the Dene Citizens Line Zone cases.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will try to do three things in my rebuttal. I want to quickly discuss some things that Graydon said that are just outrageously foreclosed by precedent to make clear that there is no gap here. Second, I want to talk a bit about adequacy, because I think that's what the government or the court's really interested about, even if it's, as the court has indicated, may have to be resolved in the future. And then I want to finish up by addressing some of this hyperbole about law-free zones and stuff like that. So real quickly, just sort of bullet points. The argument that we filed a whopping zero things in the district court, right, because we would have to waive our sovereign immunity to do so. Shermoen tells this court verbatim that argument is wrong. You cannot say, oh, you could have appeared.
Could you have filed as an amicus?
We could file as an amicus, and in both Macaw and Maverick, This court specifically held that amicus status is not adequate and does not solve the Rule 19 problem. And you can see why, Your Honor. Among other things that amici can't do is appeal, right? If we were just an amicus and the government did what they've now done, we would be up a creek without a paddle, as they say. Second, blatant misstatement of the law. Well, you can just have renewed administrative process. No, Diné rejects that at 860, says literally that is foreclosed. And it says the reason is the public rights to say, that is to say, Your Honor, having a renewed administrative process does not take you out the Rule 19 scenario, and it does not allow the public rights exception to go forward, because the public rights exception only is defeated where the lawsuit threatens to destroy the entitlement. So this court held in Diné that just saying, well, you could go back to the agency, as Grayton wants Coy to do here, and maybe you'll win in a second go-around, also foreclosed by circuit precedent. Third misstatement, Pimentel says you can look at the strength of the claims. No. The Supreme Court's opinion, Pimentel, says that was the error. What Pimentel says is you do not, as the district court in that case has done, say, well, these claims are weak, so I'm going to let it go forward. It says if the sovereign's claims are frivolous, only is the only time you can look at the strength of the claims. And no one is saying Coination's claims are frivolous. As everyone said, the government did for quite a while defend them. So, and then fourth is this idea of, well, it's brand new agency action. You know, my friend said, that's the most important thing I'm going to say. Well, he has no answer, which I just discussed. Wilbur, also, there's an injunction pending beforehand. Klamath was challenged. The actual decision there was challenged right after it happened. In White, the case was about newly discovered remains the tribe had literally never possessed. That idea, this brand new agency action, completely foreclosed by precedent. Now I want to talk a bit about adequacy. I understand the government's more, or the court's more interested in there. I want to put aside appeal for a second. I do think that makes this easy. Your Honor was right that the court was right. There was a couple of questions about that the analysis in the district court is forward-looking. The Diné Maverick question is whether they might diverge. More commonly, this court has said about 10 times, the question is whether the government undoubtedly will make in the future every argument. And there's a bunch of factors this court have recognized beyond the failure to appeal that diffuse this case. First, where tribes are opposed and they're fighting over something. And my friend just said, we think this is our land. His own brief, the Sir reply admits, that is the paradigmatic case where the government can't be an adequate representative, where it's a trustee of two tribes fighting about one thing. Well, he's telling you it's their land, we're telling you it's our land. Per se, in any circuit, the government is not an adequate representative. Another reason the government can't be an adequate representative is where it had recent past hostility with the tribe on the subject matter. This court said that in Maverick. And in Maverick, it was referring to some 1990s disputes about gambling rights. Here, as the court alluded to, the Department of Interior has been hostile to Coy Nation as recently as 2019 when they're trying to defeat the very exception at issue here. So we know that under this court's precedent, or Maverick, for example, it also, that's another factor that takes it outside of adequacy. And then finally, this statement that we never told the district court what argument we might make that they wouldn't, it's blatantly false under the record. Your Honor can look at 2ER117, 2ER199, and again at 2ER215, where we raise this exact argument that, hey, we would argue as a matter of law, which you can absolutely do under Chenery, make your legal arguments, we would argue as a matter of law the DOI regulations here that allowed them to take the land and trust are too narrow, and that under Loper Bright, the statute is all we need, and we're right under the statute, DOI's regulations notwithstanding. That exact, very specific argument was preserved in the district court three times, and I don't know why they're pretending it wasn't. But leave everything else aside. That would allow this court to find the government inadequate on a very case-specific grounds. So the district court did not abuse its discretion for all of those reasons in accurately predicting that the government would not be an adequate representative. And then finally, I'd like to use a little bit of time to deal with this law-free zone claim. No, sovereign immunity has been recognized since time immemorial as a reason to limit judicial review. It predates Marbury. It doesn't apply to all tribal land. It's undisputed. We have this incredibly narrow restored lands exception issue here. And there is absolutely nothing shocking or wrongful about a tribe using procedural arguments to win a case. Let me tell you how much Grayton believes in judicial review. They acquired their casino under the restored lands tradition exception. When that was challenged in court, not the acquisition of the land, but the casino, they moved to dismiss, and they prevailed without ever being heard on the merits. You can see this at 384 Federal Appendix 546, decision of this court. They said these people who made similar claims to Grayton's, environmental claims, we don't want a casino near us, they tried to post a casino. What did Grayton do? They said lack of Article III standing. All those folks who had the same grievances as Graydon were never heard on the merits. Graydon didn't think that was an injustice, because it's not. Because this country has always had procedural rules that protect sovereigns, that enforce standing. There's many reasons courts don't hear cases on the merits.
So, counsel, if DOI had accepted Graydon's arguments at the administrative level and decided to deny your request, your client's request to place these lands in trust, you retained ownership of the lands, but they couldn't be put in trust because DOI determined that they were of significance to the Graydon Rancheria. Would you have a right to have taken an appeal under the APA?
Well, if we had lost that determination, yes, we would be able to appeal under the APA.
And the Graydon Rancheria presumably would have come in and said, we're an indispensable party, and we would have had very similar arguments, and then they would have said, and we have sovereign immunity.
I think you would accept
that argument without protest?
I think it depends on what the decision was, Your Honor. Right. So if we had lost, the only thing that was actually at stake, which said this land should be taken in trust for us. And it just remains our fee simple lands that we own the same way you can own in your own house. I don't think they would then claim a legal entitlement. And that's not the argument they've made. They wouldn't say, right, we have a 19A interest in Koi Nation not having land. Now, Your Honor's hypothetical, I think, where not only do they say these aren't Koi Nation lands, but in fact, they are Graydon's lands and they are Graydon's trust lands and Graydon is now the sovereign over these lands. Absolutely. That is going to, under all of this court's cases, if they get sovereign title to land, then it becomes unchallengeable. There's nothing shocking about that. That's every case. And by the way, it's not a tribes always win situation. You know, in Kickapoo, a tribe lost because of that, because Kansas intervened in the case and said, you know, we're the unjoined sovereign. They won. There is a default rule that when you're challenging, not a default rule, a rule to which they've literally never found an exception, right? No case takes lands out of trust. Yes, it is true. When a sovereign has jurisdiction over land, you can't challenge that in court. This case has said again and again, that is for Congress to fix. It said it in Diné. It said it in Macaw. The Supreme Court said it for foreign sovereign immunity in Pimentel. If a sovereign has land, you don't go to court and try to say France. You don't control Alsace-Lorraine anymore, right? Congress has to pass laws when you're trying to take away sovereignty over land.
Thank you. I want to thank both sides. This case was expertly handled by all counsel, and it's the kind of case that it's such a big case that there's probably a lot of younger lawyers who worked on this case who made everybody who was at the podium look so well prepared and good. So please thank your teams. This matter is submitted. That concludes our day for the morning.